Thanks for tuning in for the August 4th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's feature interview focuses on developments in brain-machine interface to decode speech from human brain signals. In the other segment, you'll hear a discussion on expert prediction of response in clinical trials.
Hi, this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's podcast, I have the great pleasure to be interviewing Joseph Makin, who completed the work that we'll be talking about today at the Center for Integrative Neuroscience at the University of California, San Francisco, and will be starting as an assistant professor at Purdue University this upcoming year. We're going to be discussing a paper recently published in Nature Neuroscience titled Machine Translation of Cortical Activity to Text with an Encoder-Decoder Framework. So Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First off, Joe, in a paper like this, talking about machine translation of cortical activity and encoder-decoder frameworks, understanding our audience are largely practicing neurologists, would you mind just sort of explaining in concrete terms what this study entailed?
Sure, of course. First of all, you know, the one-liner is we recorded neural activity while patients were speaking and then subsequently decoded what they were speaking just by analyzing that neural activity. In more detail, the setup of the lab is the head of the lab is a neurosurgeon named Eddie Chang, and he monitors patients for epilepsy. So they come in to have a resection done because they have some kind of intractable epilepsy, basically, you know, drug resistant. And while they're in there, he monitors, first of all, for the focus of the seizure. So he surgically implants these arrays of electrodes on the surface of the brain. So electrocorticography, which I think a lot of the neurologists in your audience will probably be familiar with. It's about 256 electrodes that are sitting over the parts of the brain that are involved in speech production and speech comprehension. The location of these grids is determined by clinical needs. So basically, you know, where they think the seizure might be located. But having said that, it gives the whole lab an opportunity to study language processing in these areas. So, you know, the patient's in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And while they're there, you know, we're kind of just waiting for these seizures to happen. We, the members of the lab, we go in and we ask them, you know, would you mind taking part in these studies? We just have simple tasks where either they listen to sentences or they read sentences aloud or they just speak freely. So in this particular study, we had the participants read from a list of something like 500 sentences. And during the course of that reading, you know, we're monitoring their neural activity with this array of 256 electrodes. And so we recorded it. And then afterwards, I took that data and I used some of these very modern machine learning techniques to build a map from the neural activity, from the electrocorticogram to the speech that they were producing.
Joe, that's fascinating. And certainly you're right, our audience will be familiar with the idea of electrocorticography. But I think the idea of using machine learning to sort of decode that is one area that this is novel. We've done some interviews on this podcast before, and there have been publications in our Green Journal about the computer neuronal interface. And so I guess, again, in broad terms, how does this type of work, taking advantage of some of these newer techniques, build on that prior body of research?
Okay, so probably as everybody knows, there's been a lot of excitement in the machine learning community and computer science, and maybe even in the culture generally about these new algorithms, which actually in some sense, they're very old algorithms. The ideas behind these artificial neural networks go back really something like 50 or 60 years. But in the last decade, they've become extremely powerful, in part because of some new algorithms, but also increased computational power. You know, the main idea of an artificial neural network, it's like a way of building a very complicated function or map. There are various forms of these networks, but the main flavor, it's like a very powerful function from an input to an output. What's powerful about them is that you can construct these complicated functions out of very simple pieces. And that's important because we do think that, for instance, the relationship between neural activity and speech is complicated. So we want to be able to construct these very complicated functions. But on the other hand, the simplicity gives us a technique for improving the algorithm during the course of feeding it data. So that's what gives this algorithm the character of learning. That's why people refer to it as machine learning. There's a provably correct formula for improving the map that goes from input to output. So slowly, bit by bit, you know, you get better and better outputs. So in our case, you know, my point of departure was these recent results in machine translation. That's why translation is in the title of this paper. Basically, people have built these artificial neural networks sometime around, I think, 2015. a new kind of architecture was introduced for translating. So remember, machine translation, probably most of your audience is familiar with it in the context of like Google Translate. All right. So you put in French and you get out English, and it's not done by a human in the loop. It's purely done by algorithm. And up until about 2015 or 2016, these were done by these very complicated statistical algorithms, you know, sort of hand-wired, and a lot of engineering, a lot of domain knowledge went into it. But around that time, it was shown that these artificial neural networks, you could just build these enormous architectures that know nothing about language, and then you just train them. You put, you know, French sentences in and English sentences out, and you just tune the algorithm. You turn the little knobs on it until the output sentences are the ones that you want. What I did was I built an algorithm along those lines. And you can think about it like this. Instead of having sequences of French words as inputs and then sequences of English words as outputs, it takes sequences of this ECOG data as input. Okay, so at every moment in time, a new vector of neural activity enters this network. And at the end of, let's say, 2 seconds of data, roughly the amount of time it takes for the person to say a single sentence, the neural network has some abstract representation of that sentence, and that's passed off to another part of the network, which unfolds it into English one word at a time. So that's the basic idea. So we took these ideas from machine translation and then applied them to decoding speech from ECOG.
So Joe, obviously that's fascinating to even think about, but I'd like to hear from you what you view as sort of the practical implications of that work. How could we be thinking about this in the context of taking care of patients with neurological disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, ultimately that's our goal. That's what motivates us. There are sectors of this cottage industry now of brain-machine interfaces who are interested in things like human enhancement. I think that's something like what the folks at Neuralink are up to, at least Elon Musk. But that's not our focus. You know, what we're really interested in is providing ultimately a speech prosthesis to people who've lost the ability to speak or don't have it. So, you know, brainstem stroke, ALS, you know, other kinds of neurological damage. Now, one thing that's important to emphasize here is in our study, the participants were reading aloud. First of all, they have epilepsy, but they're not cognitively impaired. And then second of all, they're reading aloud. So they're not just freely producing silent speech, they're reading from a prompt. So that going forward, that raises a problem perhaps for getting these into a clinical population. But the thought here is that what it appears that we're decoding is something like the commands from the speech motor areas. And our idea is that if people have lost the ability to speak, but they can still send those commands, then it will still be possible to decode what they're trying to say, despite the fact that, you know, they can no longer move their speech articulators.
Yeah, that's super powerful, that idea, and would really enhance the quality of life for many of our patients, as you mentioned, who have lost the mechanical ability to speak, but that still have intact language cortex that they could turn into a speech prosthesis, as you mentioned. I take care of a lot of patients that do have injury in the language cortex from, say, a stroke, and they have aphasia or impairment of their language. And it seems like this type of prosthesis might not be able to help them as much, but certainly, as you mentioned, folks with ALS, brainstem injury, et cetera, this really could be a powerful tool in their recovery, rehabilitation, and quality of life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, probably not for people who have damage to the speech language areas, but to other areas that prevent, as you say, the mechanical production of speech. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Wow, Joe. Well, that's awesome. And I know our listeners are really excited to hear that this work is going on, and not just going on, but really is coming to life. And so as you think about this amazing work you're doing with patients, but really doing a lot on the back end with the engineering and machine learning, what can we expect in the future as far as next steps for you and your research team? And when this really could translate itself in a way that we could offer to patients?
Well, you know, I think not in the next 12 months or something, but in the next few years, I think a viable speech prosthesis will be built. But, you know, when I say next few years, let's say like perhaps a decade, but I think it's on the horizon. But, you know, there are plenty of obstacles between here and there. So from my perspective, maybe the biggest one is that we achieved, at least on one participant, error rates basically near zero, which had never been done before. And in part, that's due to the algorithm. And in part, it's due to the data we collected. But the fact is that we also relied on using a small language. Basically, we just had this set of, you know, 500 sentences. And in fact, we only tested on some subset of that. So the algorithm basically learned the statistical structure, not just of English, but of this very particular small set of sentences. And it used that to help decode. So it's important for us to expand beyond this. We want a more flexible language. We want to build an algorithm that can produce ultimately, maybe not all of English, but, you know, given a vocabulary of 5,000 words, can produce any combination of those words. So, you know, we haven't done that yet. We need to get there. And I think to get there, one thing we're going to have to do is collect a lot more data. So these patients, you know, we get maybe half an hour of data from each of them. That's just what the total amount of speaking time adds up to over the course of these maybe week that they're in the hospital. So we need more data, and then we need to improve these algorithms. And in fact, there have been advances in machine translation also in the past couple of years. So I think some of those ideas we can import. And then I would say the last kind of obstacle or the big thing that's on our radar is in people who haven't spoken for perhaps years, you know, we're thinking here of a case like ALS or, as you say, damage to the brainstem, it's possible that there's been cortical reorganization. And that means that it might not be so simple as just having them try to produce the sentences that we had our participants produce and train our algorithm from there. So that's a complication that's off on the horizon.
And that is a fair point, but these seem like obstacles that can be overcome. And so a lot of hope out there for neurologists, for other researchers, and of course for patients. So Joe, that's all just very exciting. Any final thoughts as we wrap up?
I just want to say thanks a lot for having me on here and sharing this work. I'm very excited about it also. And we'll see where we go from here.
Well, absolutely. And with that, I want to encourage all of our listeners out there. This is just a smattering of a really exciting paper, and I'd encourage you all to seek it out in Nature Neuroscience, again, titled Machine Translation of Cortical Activity to Text with an Encoder-Decoder Framework. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and have a nice day.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and I'm on the phone today with Jonathan Kimmelman. He is a bioethicist and director of the Biomedical Ethics Unit at McGill University in Montreal. And for today's podcast, we're talking about his paper published in this week's issue of the journal Neurology titled Wisdom of the Expert Crowd Prediction of Response for Three Neurology Randomized Trials. Jonathan, it's wonderful to have you join us on the Neurology Podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So your paper is different than many of the papers we typically cover on our podcast. And I know that neurologists will find it interesting because in addition to neurology, it kind of has this flavor of something else. I'm not sure if I'd call it behavioral decision-making or bioethics, but before we get into the paper, what do you think is the take-home message? What do you think that we as neurologists could learn from this paper to help us better take care of our patients?
I think one of the key take-home messages is that it's really, really tough for neurologists to accurately predict the outcomes of clinical trials. The paper is an exploratory paper. It's a small number of trials that we've looked at, but what seems like a pretty clear message is that it's really, really hard for neurologists to predict treatment responses for patients in clinical trials. And so I think that one of the sort of really important take-home messages here is that expert opinion is really no substitute for doing a proper randomized control trial. And it ought to fill us with a lot of skepticism about any kind of forum where decisions are made primarily based on expert opinion as opposed to the results of well-designed clinical trials.
Terrific. So part of the background for the paper is that as neurologists, as you kind of alluded to, we tend to overestimate our ability to make predictions regarding clinical outcomes. But you make the point that groups of experts in theory should be able to do this, should be able to make predictions with some degree of skill. Can you help me understand this point and maybe help me wrap my mind around this?
Sure. Yeah, it's complicated stuff. I think we're used to thinking about prediction and uncertainty in binary terms, that you're either totally uncertain or you have total knowledge. We're used to thinking about predictions in many settings as being determinate. So either something's going to happen or not. But the reality is that predictions always have a certain amount of uncertainty behind them. So you can think about this in the context of a weather forecast. You know, if you go to a meteorologist and you ask them for the weather, one meteorologist might give you totally random predictions, somewhere between 0 and 100%. So that's one form of uncertainty. Another form of uncertainty is if the meteorologist is telling you 50% chance of rain every day, et cetera. So, you know, the random predictions are much more uncertain than a 50% prediction, right? There's still a lot of uncertainty with a 50% prediction. You don't know whether it's going to rain or not. But at least there's some information in there with a 50% prediction. There may be, you know, meteorological conditions are pointing to the possibility of rain, but some meteorological conditions are pointing against the rain. And so the point is, when you ask neurologists in this study for predictions, what you want are informative predictions, predictions that are going to kind of give you some information about the prospect of patients responding in the clinical trial.
I think I understand. So as neurologists, we should at least be able to do better than just randomly selecting a percentage likelihood of something happening. Is that kind of the point?
Exactly. That's exactly the point. Right. So whenever you do prediction studies, you're always trying to benchmark your forecasters, your experts, against some other benchmark. And one really, really simple benchmark is just totally random predictions. Can experts do better than a random number generator? You should be able to beat at least a random number generator. So let's move this back into the context of clinical trials, because this will help to explain it a little bit better. So, you know, if you were to ask a bunch of neurologists to predict whether a group of clinical trials are going to meet their primary outcome, they ought to be able to do better than just generating random predictions. For example, they ought to know that only about 40% of randomized controlled trials, or 30%, somewhere in that range, are positive on the primary endpoint. So if they were to predict 30% for each of those trials, that would still give you a more accurate forecast of the positivity on those trials than would a random number generator. Even though there's a lot of uncertainty, if you predict a 30% chance of a trial being positive, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty around that prediction.
So with that as kind of an introduction, I thought about introducing this paper as humans versus machines, because as I understand it, this is kind of what you did, right? You took three randomized clinical trials within neurology that were nearing completion, and you used them to see how well neurologists could predict the outcome of those trials with respect to their primary endpoint. And you compared neurologist predictions to just random computer-generated predictions that gave an equal probability to every possible outcome. So you called these uninformed predictions. And again, these three trials involve neurological studies. So one involved natalizumab for patients with acute stroke, one looked at vitamin D in relapsing remitting MS, and one tested risagiline in ALS. What other details should we know? Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's basically right. Those were the three trials that we used for our prediction studies. We went to a group of investigators on those trials, as well as a group of disease specialists that were not involved in those trials. And what we did is we asked them to predict the outcome for each trial of patients in the placebo group, as well as patients in the treatment group.
And so how did we do? How did neurologists do in predicting the outcomes of these trials?
In general, not especially well. So our primary goal was to see whether or not if we took a group of neurologists, asked them to predict the outcomes of patients in the placebo and the treatment group, and if we pooled or averaged their predictions, whether or not we could get an accurate read on what the outcomes would be for patients in each of those groups. And generally, neurologists were not able to do any better than what I called those uninformative predictions, those predictions that sort of made no commitments to outcomes across the range of possibilities. So, of course, the results differed from one trial to another. In particular, neurologists had a really, really hard time with the stroke trial. I think that partly reflects the fact that the stroke trial was using an imaging endpoint that was probably unfamiliar to most of the participants in that study. Whereas for MS and ALS, for those trials, the neurologists were at least in the ballpark of having accurate predictions, although they didn't necessarily do that well. So basically, for MS as well as ALS, predictions were about the same as what that uninformative algorithm would have predicted. So that's not a great outcome. On the other hand, there are a couple silver linings that are in there. I think one silver lining is that for the MS trial, about 3/4 of neurologists' predictions fell within the sort of range of uncertainty for those neurologists. And the other thing I want to say about the MS and the ALS, and this is also true of the stroke study, is that neurologists, for the most part, were pretty pessimistic about those trials having a positive outcome. We didn't exactly ask them clearly whether or not they thought there would be a positive or a non-positive outcome on the primary endpoint, but you can sort of combine their predictions and look at whether or not their predictions imply that they thought there would be a positive outcome on the primary endpoint. And for all three studies, neurologists accurately predicted that the results would be null results. And so to me, what that suggests is that, you know, the problem of prediction is not necessarily that neurologists have an unrealistic sense of the probability of neurology trials hitting their primary endpoint.
Terrific. I was just sitting here thinking, you know, why did we not do so great? And I guess one of the potential reasons, as you've already addressed, is that maybe it has to do with the endpoint. And so for an endpoint that we're not as familiar with, like some kind of imaging finding, radiographic finding, then we might not be as good estimating a result when it's something that we're not as familiar with. Any other speculation about why we maybe performed not so hot?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, our study wasn't able to really probe the reasons, but I do have some speculations. I think one of the issues that is seen again and again in studies of experts is that experts tend to be a bit overconfident. They tend to think they know more than they actually know. If you think about what it is to be an expert, what it is to be a neurologist, it's really, really hard to know what the boundaries of your knowledge and competencies would be. And so I think that part of the problem here is that oftentimes neurologists in the study offered predictions that were more confident than they should have been. There should have been more uncertainty in the predictions. So again, if we get back to the way the study was designed, so we used a benchmark of these uninformative forecasts. So that's as if they predicted the same probability of outcome across the range of possibilities. That's a completely unconfident forecast. But the essence is that, you know, again, if you go back to the way that we asked for predictions, we asked people to predict what they thought the best possible outcome for the study would be, the worst possible outcome, and what they thought was the most likely outcome. And so we captured a range of their beliefs. And generally, the difference between the best possible and the worst possible outcome was not as large as it should have been. And what that suggests is that the participants in our study tended to underestimate the uncertainty around outcomes of patients in the placebo as well as in the treatment group. So I think that's sort of probably one of the key take-home messages in this, although it's important to emphasize this was an exploratory study. But I think one of the key take-home messages is that when you're making decisions based on low level of evidence, it's important to have a lot of humility about the accuracy of the judgments that you're making. It's important to recognize the uncertainty because we all have a tendency as experts to overestimate our ability to make predictions based on low level of evidence.
So, Jonathan, some people out there might be asking, well, what does it really matter how good neurologists are at predicting the outcomes of clinical trials? What would you say to that?
So I think there's a couple of different answers. One answer is that we don't always have high level of evidence available for us at any given moment. So right now, for example, we're dealing with this COVID-19 pandemic. Unfortunately, we don't have a mountain of high quality trial evidence to tell us how to manage COVID-19. And so in those kinds of settings, you're going to have to go to experts to get their opinions and judgments about which treatments to use. And so, you know, part of the goal of a project like this is to look at how well experts can actually anticipate the efficacy of new treatments when there is low level of evidence available. And if you pool expert judgments in particular ways, whether you can get more accurate assessments than you would if you were to just ask individual experts. So, you know, what's true for COVID-19 is also true in general for neurology or any other area of medicine. Many different treatments are made on the basis of low level of evidence. A lot of off-label treatments are supported by low level observational studies. Oftentimes, clinical practice guideline recommendations are based on expert advice as opposed to high level of evidence because that high level evidence isn't available. And so part of what this allows us to get at in a study like this is a sense of how reliable those recommendations are going to be when they're based on low level of evidence.
Yeah, so quite simply, this is just a scenario we encounter a lot where we just can't run randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials for every clinical scenario that we want to have an answer to.
Exactly. So I think there are a couple other sort of important take-home messages, although again, I do want to emphasize this is an exploratory study. It's the first of its kind. And, you know, some of these findings I would want to see replicated before I make policy on them. But I think there are a couple other sort of key take-home messages that kind of connect back to your point. You know, in general, what we found is that when you ask a lot of experts for their opinion and you pool their predictions, those predictions tend to be more accurate than would be the predictions of individual experts. So in other words, if you score individual experts and you average their prediction scores, their scores will generally be worse than would be the score of a prediction algorithm that simply averaged together the predictions of all the different experts. And so what that means is that when we have a lot of uncertainty about whatever it is, you know, about outcomes for an unproven intervention, et cetera, it's often going to be really useful to go to a group of different experts, get their opinion and aggregate their opinion. That's going to be a much more effective tool than to try to find the single expert who you think has the most expertise and ask that individual for their opinion.
Yeah, terrific. So it sounds like really trying to get a wide range of viewpoints is more valuable than just depending on any single viewpoint. Any other interesting findings we should know about?
I think there are a couple other elements in the paper that I think are sort of interesting. So one of the things that we did in this paper is we had sort of two strata in our sample. We had experts who were co-investigators on the trial, as well as experts who had an arm's length relationship with the trial, who may have known about the trial, but were not actually running the trial. And one of the things we wanted to see is whether or not people who are actually running the trials could provide more accurate predictions, and also whether they were more optimistic about outcomes or more pessimistic or whatever. And one of the sort of secondary findings in our analysis was that individuals who are co-investigators in the trial were not necessarily more optimistic about outcomes, and they weren't necessarily more or less accurate than independent experts. And so on the one hand, you know, that's somewhat reassuring to know that people who are enrolling patients in clinical trials have just as realistic a grasp of the prospect of favorable outcomes for patients in that trial as would independent experts. In other words, if you're conducting informed consent, you know, to me, this allays some of my anxieties that people who are recruiting patients into their own trials may have a somewhat slanted view of the prospect of benefit for patients. So that's one, I think, really encouraging finding. And I think the other encouraging finding, although, you know, it's both encouraging and discouraging, is that, again, across all three of these trials, neurologists were pretty skeptical that any of these three trials would hit their primary endpoint with statistical significance. And so to me, what this suggests is that, you know, neurology, it's a tough field to make, you know, therapeutic innovations. It's one of the toughest fields in medicine. And to me, you know, what this suggests is that neurologists really appreciate just how difficult it is to show a therapeutic benefit for, you know, a stroke treatment or an ALS treatment. So in a sense, what that conveys is a sense of, you know, realism in the neurological community. So, you know, I think this is a reminder that when we have low level of evidence about a treatment being effective, one of the key take-home messages from our paper is that we ought to have a lot of humility about our expectations that that treatment is going to have a therapeutic effect. You know, I think that it's easy to be seduced by a very compelling story about the mechanism of a new treatment. It's easy to be seduced by positive experiences with using a particular drug or good case reports, but we ought to recognize that when the level of evidence around these treatments is pretty low, we have a very, very hard time predicting whether or not that treatment effect is going to carry over to broader populations.
Terrific and well said. I really am glad that you and your team put this out there for us to chew on and to serve as a reminder. And I encourage our listeners to check out the paper. Again, it's available in this week's issue of Neurology, and the title is Wisdom of the Expert Crowd Prediction of Response for Three Neurology Randomized Trials. Jonathan, thank you again for your hard work and for spending a few minutes with us today.
Thanks a lot for your interest. Take care.
Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.